It's Thursday, June 18th. This is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, the U.S. economy is in the spotlight as the Federal Reserve Chairman speaks out about recovery and policy.
Nobody wants to see us step backwards. Nobody wants to, I think, go back to a kind of Cold War status.
Russia's president reveals plans to increase his nuclear weapons arsenal. Also ahead, some popular singers are about to become more popular with new music. It's all ahead on today's International Edition. Top officials of the U.S. Central Bank say American economic growth has recovered from a slump in the first few months of this year and is strong enough to warrant raising interest rates in the future. The Federal Reserve left interest rates steady at the record low level where they have been since 2008. Cutting the rates to nearly zero was intended to stimulate economic growth during the economic crisis by making it cheap to borrow money. Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen told journalists on Wednesday that the economy is currently expanding moderately and is on track to grow at a rate of 1.8 to 2% this year. Yellen said the Fed will raise rates when officials see further improvement in the labor market and are reasonably confident that inflation will eventually hit the 2% annual rate that they think is good for economic growth. Senior economist Gus Foucher of PNC Bank says that most likely means that the Fed will begin raising interest rates very slightly, about one quarter of a percentage point in September, and perhaps make a second slight increase later in the year. The announcements came at the end of 2 days of meetings here in Washington, where Fed officials debated interest rate policy and other economic issues. The Federal Reserve, of course, released a press release. And in the press release, they said that consistent with their statutory mandate, the committee seeks to foster maximum employment and price stability. The committee expects that with appropriate policy accommodation, economic activity will expand at a moderate pace, with labor market indicators continuing to move forward at levels that the committee judges consistent with its dual mandate. It also continues to see risks to the outlook for the economic activity and the labor market as nearly balanced. Inflation currently anticipated to remain at its recent low level in the near term. However, the committee expects inflation to rise gradually toward 2% over the medium term as the labor market continues to improve further and transitory effects of earlier declines in energy and import prices dissipate. And they continue to monitor inflation developments closely. The committee is maintaining its existing policy of reinvesting principal payments from its holdings of agency debt and agency mortgage-backed securities in agency mortgage-backed securities and rolling over maturing Treasury securities at auction. And that policy, they say, keeps the committee's holdings of longer-term securities at sizable levels. Well, certainly people have been reacting to this somewhat on social media. Michael Lippin joins me in the studio live to see what's happening out there. Michael, how are you doing?
Good, yes. So we saw interest in the topic of the Federal Reserve jump on Twitter today as the central bank's meeting ended and Chairwoman Janet Yellen shared her thoughts on the economy with reporters. The three-letter word Fed, which many people use on Twitter as a shorthand, has been tweeted more than 50,000 times in the past day. That's the highest number of tweets in the last month, according to the Topsy Analytics site. A couple of Fed-related tweets caught my eye. One is from the Reuters news agency's editor of U.S. investments, Jennifer Ablan. She used her handle, @JenAblan, to tweet her latest report on when U.S. market traders think we'll get our first Fed interest rate hike since 2008. Okay, here is a spoiler alert. She said the traders who spoke to Reuters see a 66% chance of a December rate hike and a 49% chance of an October rate hike. Then there was this tweet from the Yahoo Finance news site. Fed up with Fed talk? Investors suffer from macro fatigue. Okay, a little play on words there from Yahoo Finance, which included a link to its Fed story by Michael Santoli. Santoli writes that most U.S. investors are tired of central bankers like Janet Yellen and others driving the action in financial markets. and would prefer a situation in which the market focuses on evaluating industries and businesses and selecting the potential winners from losers.
Interesting. Well, speaking of winners and losers, who wins and loses when the Fed eventually does raise interest rates again?
You know, Jim, that is actually the topic of a Bloomberg Business article that I found on Twitter. Bloomberg Business uses the handle @business, not a bad handle, and tweeted a link to its story about the expected winners and losers from a rate hike, and about those people whose fortunes are likely to stay steady. A quick highlight here of those three categories for you. Bloomberg's main winner is the greenback, another name for the U.S. dollar. The main loser is the U.S. federal budget. And Bloomberg predicts a draw for U.S. savers. Jim?
Well, we're always a big winner when Michael follows all the developments on social media. Thank you for stopping by. Yes. @Michael_Lippin is his handle on Twitter. Please follow him. This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information. For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at VOANews.com.
VOANews.com.
That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at VOANews.com.
VOANews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry on Tuesday expressed concern over remarks by Russian President Vladimir Putin at a military expo near Moscow that more than 40 new intercontinental ballistic missiles will be added to the country's nuclear arsenal this year.
We're trying to move in the opposite direction. We've had enormous cooperation from the 1990s forward with respect to the destruction of nuclear weapons that were in former territories of the Soviet Union. And nobody wants to see us step backwards. Nobody wants to, I think, go back to a kind of Cold War status. It could well be posturing with respect to negotiations because of their concerns about military moves being made by NATO itself. The assurance program that's in place for the forward states, as well as potentially the missile defense deployment plan. So it's really hard to tell. But nobody should hear that kind of announcement from the leader of a powerful country and not be concerned about what the implications are.
The U.S. State Department says Russia currently has more than 500 deployed intercontinental ballistic missiles, submarine-launched ballistic missiles, and heavy bombers carrying a total of nearly 1,600 nuclear warheads. Mr. Putin's comments come amid tensions with the West over, among other things, a conflict in Ukraine. Jonathan Adelman is an associate professor of international studies at the University of Denver. He told VOA's Victor Beatty the Russian leader senses opportunity to pursue his effort to reestablish Russian influence over its former Soviet states.
It's his feeling that the United States is in semi-withdrawal from key areas around the world, and the Russians want to demonstrate that they are still a powerful country. And there's something else that isn't getting as much attention, and that is the advanced age of our whole nuclear fleet. President Obama has already offered a $1 trillion program, 30 years modernization. The average age of an American nuclear warhead is 27 years, and many places that ICBMs are launched, say the Minutemen, for example, from the United States, are as much as 50 years old, and sometimes even they can't even be totally closed because they are so old, and it's too dangerous to try to change it. So in addition to this issue, which is a major one, there is a broader issue where the Russians are modernizing their nuclear forces, and we are not, and therefore this gives them somewhat of an advantage, although, of course, God forbid we ever should have nuclear war.
Are they breaking any arms control treaties?
Well, they're breaking at least promises that they made, verbal promises that they made, going back to the SALT treaties in the 1970s and then the more recent treaties, where they agreed to hold their nuclear forces, which right now are roughly similar to ours. So they may not be breaking the letter of the law, they're definitely breaking the spirit of the law.
This follows a New York Times report that the United States is considering deploying heavy weapons and possibly even troops in Eastern Europe. You see any linkage?
Oh, absolutely. I think that's really what the issue is, that our fear is that now that Crimea has gone and Abkhazia and Ossetia and Georgia is gone, and the Russians now are consolidating their hold over part of left bank Ukraine or part of eastern Ukraine, that the next obvious victim would be the very small Baltic countries, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. And therefore, the reality is that with the British and French and Germans having a grand total of less than 1,000 mainline battle tanks and being basically unprepared for any kind of warfare, but not even traditional warfare, even the kind that the Russians have been waging, this is an important symbol that we're sending them. It's not something that's going to make a lot of difference on the field of battle. They're talking about brigades of 3,500 to 5,000 men. They're talking about 100 or 200 tanks and so forth. But still, it would be an important symbol that we do regard this as very important and that NATO remains one for all and all for one.
What factor does the conflict in Ukraine play with regard to Eastern European concerns about Russia's intentions?
Well, it's an excellent question because it plays hugely. And I think Americans have problems thinking about that, and Canadians and Latin Americans, because they are 4,000 miles away. But for the countries that are in the Baltics, they're looking at being 100 miles away or a couple of hundred miles away, and they're concerned that their own armed forces are very small. We have to remember that NATO on the whole is spending less than 2% of their entire GNP on weapons of any sort. The British just announced that within 5 years, and they used to be a major power, that they are going to have 80,000 men in their infantry. So if the United States doesn't do it, the obvious question is who is going to try to prevent this, especially since of the three Baltic countries, one of them already is 25% Russian, another one has a significant Russian population, and this is what the Russians will play on at home and then abroad, that we will bring back the Russia as a superpower.
Jonathan Edelman also says while the arms buildup will tax the weakened Russian economy, it will provide employment to technicians, scientists, and engineers, many of whom are immigrating to the West and Israel. This is VOA. The Sacramento Kings are the latest champions of the National Basketball Association. They beat the Cleveland Cavaliers 4-2 in the best-of-seven finals. Max Willens writes for the International Business Times. He's been following this year's finals, and Max, there were some extremely large audiences for the games.
That's right. The NBA Finals concluded Tuesday night, and the following morning, Nielsen passed ESPN and ABC what are called overnight ratings, which look at how many people were tuned in the majority of the U.S. market. And based on those numbers, this year's NBA Finals averaged a rating of 13.9, which is going to make this year's Finals the most widely watched NBA Finals since Michael Jordan was destroying anything and everything that got in his way back in the 90s.
Wow, those are some amazing numbers. What made this finals so popular?
The joke used to be that the then NBA Commissioner David Stern would hope and pray for two big market teams to wind up in the finals, because if you have teams that are followed and rooted for by people living in markets like New York or Los Angeles, then you're going to automatically have a nice big foundation of eyeballs to base your numbers on. But I think that the success that you're seeing this year has more to do with just the transcendent appeal of a guy like LeBron James and a really wonderful team game that you see in a team like the Golden State Warriors. Obviously, San Francisco, where the Warriors are based, is a pretty big media market. It's the sixth biggest in the United States, but Cleveland is not terribly large. It's the 19th largest. And what you're really seeing is a lot of people interested in whether LeBron James, who has cemented his status as, you know, one of the 10 or 15 biggest players in NBA history, whether he could deliver something that Cleveland has been waiting 50 years for, and that's a pro sports championship.
And Golden State itself erasing quite a long drought.
That's exactly right. I mean, everyone spends a lot of time talking about how much agony and how long Cleveland has had to wait for a championship. But if you're a diehard Warriors fan, you've been waiting 40 years. That was the last time the Golden State Warriors won a title was in 1975. And so this has been a long time coming for that fan base as well.
Things have changed quite a bit since Michael Jordan's day, at least in the way that people can follow the NBA now. There's so many different ways besides just watching it on TV, and that must have helped the numbers a little bit.
Yeah, that's a really good point, I think. The NBA was one of the first North American sports leagues to really embrace the opportunity afforded by things like social media and platforms like YouTube. It's funny to think about now, but in the early days when YouTube was first sort of ascendant and becoming a thing that people looked to for video entertainment and content all the time, a lot of sports leagues were very resistant, even hostile to YouTube. They would ban anybody from uploading footage of games or content related to it. But the NBA went the other way, and they said, wait a second, this is a great opportunity to promote our product and to get people talking about it on a daily basis. And that's why, at this point, the NBA is just leaps and bounds ahead of most other American sports leagues in terms of its social media presence. And they're also, they've been smart about making their content digitally available too. This past game of the NBA Finals was watched by nearly a million people on the Watch ESPN app, which I think embraced of digital as a place for people to consume their product.
Max Willens is a staff writer for International Business Times. Max, thank you so much for joining us.
Happy to be here.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Hi there, this is Larry London, the host of Border Crossings. Nice to meet you. I would love for you to join us each and every day, Monday through Friday, on Border Crossings for requests, dedications, giveaways, and surprise guests. We've got some of today's biggest hitmakers coming into the studio to talk about their music. And all we're missing is you. So join us Monday to Friday, right here on Border Crossings. This is the Voice of America.
Two well-known female singers are back with new music. Back in our studio, David Byrd and Shauna Renee to sing their praises.
Multiple Grammy winner Jill Scott has a new album and a new tour, and Miss Jackson is set to hit the road with her new compositions. I'm David Byrd. We're talking with Shauna Renee about Jill Scott. Let's talk Jill Scott first. Philadelphia native, beautiful, soulful, rich kind of voice. Got a new album out called Woman.
Yeah, incredible artist. She right now, I think, is the face of this neo-soul movement. Even though, according to what I've read, this new album, Woman, is a departure from what we're used to hearing from Jill. She described it as classic Philly soul, which we've come to expect from her, meets country rhythm served with captivating storytelling. Again, something that we are used to, but the country rhythm I thought was a very interesting change and a shift for her. And then I also know that if the song we heard a while ago, You Don't Know, is any indication of what we might hear, there's a lot of classic blues influence in her new music as well, which is all very exciting. I can't wait.
Did you ever know what it is to be hurt? Did you ever feel like dirt? Did you ever give up? Just to have him.
it's what we used to call a pain song.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. You feel it. Like when, and even when you see her perform it, you know that on some level, she feels it as well. And she's been very honest about what she's gone through in her personal life, and it always comes out in her music. And I think that's part of that captivating storytelling that she's always been known for and that we'll hear more of.
And she's touring to support this album, too, which I understand some of the dates, they're already don't even bother trying to get tickets.
Oh, absolutely. It's been a while since we've seen her on a full tour, and fans of Jill Scott know that you really can't experience her fullness until you do it live. You have to see her, be there, and feel the music all around you. So, yeah, those who were lucky enough to get in early will have quite a show to enjoy.
Now, speaking of touring, I understand that Janet Jackson is going to go on tour in a couple of months. She's got a new album coming out. It's been 7 years since she put out an album?
It's been 7 years since she's put out an album. She hasn't toured since 2011. She's kind of been doing her own thing. She recently got married, and she's been living over in the Middle East, well, between there and here in the United States, and everyone was wondering whether or not she would ever come back to music, and she kept putting out little bits and pieces on social media saying, I'm coming, I've got stuff. But now we have the official announcement. There will be a new album, and there will be a full world tour to support that project coming up starting in mid to late August.
All right, that's Shauna Renee. You can hit Shauna up at @VOA_music. You can also listen for her in the Soul Lounge. You can find the link to that on our website. That's voanews.com.
I was chasing fool's gold.
You've been listening to International Edition, and you can find us at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
5 years ago, Burma, newly emerging from 5 decades of military rule, started moving toward an increasingly democratic rule. According to senior U.S. government officials, Assistant Secretary for Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor Tom Malinowski, Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary for East Asian and Pacific Affairs Scott Marcial, and Assistant Administrator for USAID Jonathan Stivers, in testimony before the U.S. House Foreign Affairs Committee on June 11th, Burma is undergoing an evolution, not a revolution, with each step carefully negotiated between representatives of its old and new orders. Burma is still dealing with the multiple legacies of its former dictatorship, one of the world's longest-running armed conflicts, a constitution that grants the military extraordinary powers, and ethnic and religious tensions that cannot be addressed in a closed society and that irresponsible political forces can exploit in a society that is opening. This is an important year for Burma, which will hold a national election in November. A successful transition to democracy will depend on the government's continued dialogue with civil society, ethnic groups, and the political opposition to build trust and foster national reconciliation. Constitutional amendments to reduce the military's role in the civilian government and improve the people's ability to elect leaders of their choice, and additional measures to protect the rights of members of ethnic and religious minorities. The country is ethnically diverse, with 135 officially recognized ethnic nationalities and a history of ethnic conflict. The humanitarian situation in Rakhine State remains grim, and we continue to underscore with the Burmese government the importance of addressing the root causes driving Rohingya migrants to leave their country. The Burmese government has begun to take steps to resolve some of the long-standing problems, including engaging in negotiations with ethnic armed groups in the country. In his testimony before the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Assistant Secretary Malinowski noted that it is critical that the parties engage in an inclusive, transparent, and meaningful political dialogue that addresses long-standing differences. The United States, in coordination with other members of the international community, will continue to support the peace process going forward. This is an opportunity for Burma to set an example of peaceful transition to democracy for other countries in the region.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello, and welcome back to the program that helps you learn and improve your American English. Today, we take you to the classroom for a real English lesson with Jill Robbins and Jonathan Evans. It is a special program, and if you listen carefully, you can learn a lot. Did you know that one very small and simple English word often causes confusion for English students? That is just one of the many things we have for you on today's special As It Is program. Here is Jill to start things off.
What word appears most often in English? It's the, also known as the definite article. Its partner, the indefinite article, a, is also among the top 10 most frequent words in English. According to Professor Elka Todeva of the SIT Graduate Institute in Brattleboro, Vermont, a and the are also some of the most difficult words for learners to figure out how to use without some assistance. A, an, and the are called articles. Why are these small words so hard to learn? More than 200 languages do not have articles. Other languages have articles, but use them differently than English does. As a result, figuring out the logic of English articles can be challenging.
Professor Todeva says English article usage falls into certain patterns. A basic understanding of common patterns can make learning articles easier. Fairy tales capture one such powerful pattern, which Elka Todeva calls the the switch. The the switch occurs between the first and second mention. It is a shift from new to already familiar information. Listen for the articles as she reads an example. Pay attention to the way a turns into the with the second mention of the old man and the old woman.
Once upon a time, there was an old man and an old woman who lived in a little cottage in a vast open field. The old woman and the old man were very hungry, so the old woman decided to bake a gingerbread man.
Before we explore this pattern and fairy tales further, let us look at some basic rules for article usage.
A and an are indefinite articles used before non-specific members of a group or category of nouns. The article a appears before singular nouns starting with a consonant sound. For example, I ate a banana. The article an comes before singular nouns beginning with a vowel sound. For example, give me an apple. The is called a definite article. The appears before nouns which are specific members of a category, as in, I want to see the movie George Clooney just made. Also, use the with previously mentioned nouns. For example, we went to a movie last night. The movie was called Spy. Use the with unique things like the sun, the moon, the front door, and the tallest man in the world.
In some situations, there is no article before a noun. Grammarians call this the zero article. The zero article appears before proper nouns, names like Picasso and John Lennon. It also goes with names of places and institutions, which consist of a proper name and another noun, as in Michigan State University. There is also no article before the names of days, months, seasons, and holidays. There is no article before geographical names like Europe, Italy, Tokyo, and Lake Superior. The zero article applies to names of languages and nationalities, as with Chinese or English. For example, Spanish is spoken in Spain. But if you are describing the people of that country, use the definite article. The Spanish are known for being friendly. The zero article also goes with names of sports and academic subjects.
Professor Todeva is both a learner and teacher of English. She says the human brain loves patterns and finding logic behind things. She encourages teachers and learners to explore grammatical patterns in fun, engaging ways. She calls this grammaring. Let's look at some common patterns in article usage. Professor Todeva takes us back to fairy tales or traditional stories to demonstrate how the switch from a to the works.
This particular pattern is very beautifully illustrated in most English fairy tales and in many jokes as well. Most fairy tales in English start with once upon a time. There is suspense, there is sweet anticipation. We're not sure what the story is about yet. We expect something exciting and something new, thus the use of the indefinite article at the beginning of most fairy tales, as in the following piece from The Gingerbread Man. Once upon a time, there was an old man and an old woman who lived in a little cottage, first mentioned, in a vast open field.
Here, the storyteller uses the indefinite articles because the characters are new to the listener or reader. When the information becomes familiar, the storyteller uses the definite article, the.
The old woman and the old man were very hungry, so the old woman decided to bake a gingerbread man.
You might notice the the switch in most jokes. Here is an example.
A man walks into a doctor's office. He has a cucumber up his nose, a carrot in his left ear, and a banana in his right ear. What's wrong with me? He asked the doctor, because it's already implied, and the doctor says, you're not eating properly.
Notice how the joke sets the stage with new information first. It starts with a before switching to the.
Another important pattern involves general statements. General statements refer to all or many members of a group. For example, politicians only care about money. You will often see general statements on bumper stickers. These are small labels on the back of cars that express the owner's feelings or opinions. You might see bumper stickers that say, well-behaved women rarely make history, or teachers touch the future. Notice that general statements use the zero article. Here's another general statement that you will probably agree with. Articles are challenging for English learners. Look for a future everyday grammar with more tips for using articles. Take Professor Tadeva's advice and let your brain pay attention to some of the patterns that we just explored. Happy learning and grammaring with the English language. For VOA Learning English Everyday Grammar, I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Jill Robbins.
You are listening to the Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. Health officials in South Korea have reported 3 new deaths from Middle East respiratory syndrome. This brings the total number of dead to 19 as of Tuesday. Before we continue, you may need to know the meanings of the following words as they are used in this story. To discharge is to let someone leave a hospital. To be stable means to be in good condition. An outbreak is a rapid increase in the number of cases of a disease. And to quarantine is to keep people or animals away from others, usually to prevent a disease from spreading. Now on to the story. South Korea is experiencing the largest outbreak of Middle East respiratory syndrome outside of the Middle East. All the infections have taken place in South Korean hospitals or medical centers. One of the largest hospitals in South Korea partially suspended operations Monday after hospital officials confirmed the presence of the virus. Song Ja-hun is president of Samsung Hospital. He told reporters on Sunday that the hospital would suspend all non-emergency medical operations and no longer accept new patients. He said visitors are barred from the hospital. He will decide on June 24th whether to keep the suspension in place. The government announced it would send inspectors to the hospital to investigate why it failed to control the spread of the virus. On Saturday, a team of World Health Organization experts said the number of MERS infections was falling across South Korea. But they described the disease outbreak as large and complex and said more cases should be expected. South Korean officials hope the country's improved measures will stop the spread of the disease. Kwon Jun-wook is the head of a special MERS task force in the South Korean Ministry of Health and Welfare. He says his group is watching the 12 hospitals where the virus has been found. He says there is no sign of new infections of people who are not already being quarantined. About 5,000 South Koreans are thought to have come into contact with infected individuals. They have been forced to live apart from others, and their movements are restricted. The Reuters News Service reported that thousands of South Korean schools reopened on Monday, but hundreds remain closed. The schools had been closed because of concerns about MERS. Worries about the virus have spread to other parts of Asia. Last week, the government in Hong Kong declared a red alert, advising against non-essential travel to South Korea. MERS was first identified in Saudi Arabia in 2012. It can cause pneumonia and kidney failure. There is no vaccine or cure for MERS. The World Health Organization says the disease kills about 35% of those it infects. I'm Ana Mateo.
This is Doug Johnson.
And this is Phil Murray with The Making of a Nation, a VOA special English program about the history of the United States. Today, we continue the story of America's 36th president, Lyndon Johnson.
After John Kennedy was murdered, Vice President Lyndon Johnson served the last 14 months of Kennedy's term. He then was elected to his own full term. It began in January 1965. Much of his time and energy would be taken up by the war in Vietnam. By early 1964, America had about 17,000 troops in Vietnam. The troops were there to advise and train the South Vietnamese military.
Vietnam had gained its independence from France in 1954. The country was divided into North and South. The North had a communist government led by Ho Chi Minh. The South had an anti-communist government led by Ngo Dinh Diem. In 1957, communist rebels, Viet Cong, began a campaign of terrorism in South Vietnam. They were supported by the government of North Vietnam and later by North Vietnamese troops. Their goal was to overthrow the anti-communist government in the South. President Johnson believed that the United States had to support South Vietnam. Many other Americans agreed. They believed that without American help, South Vietnam would become communist. Then all of Southeast Asia would become communist too.
As Johnson's term began, his military advisors told him the communists were losing the war. They told him that North Vietnamese troops and Viet Cong forces would soon stop fighting. On February 6th, however, the Viet Cong attacked American camps at Pleiku and Quinon. The Johnson administration immediately ordered air attacks against military targets in the North.
Some observers in the United States questioned the administration's policy. For example, a leading newspaper writer, James Reston, said President Johnson was carrying out an undeclared and unexplained war in Vietnam. Johnson defended his policies. He said withdrawal would not bring an end to the conflict. He said the battle would continue in one country and then another.
In March 1965, the first American ground troops arrived in South Vietnam. Congress supported the president's actions at the time. However, the number of Americans who opposed the war began to grow. These people said the war was a civil war. They said the United States had no right or reason to intervene.
For 6 days in May, the United States halted air attacks on North Vietnam. The administration hoped this would help get the North Vietnamese government to begin negotiations. The North refused, and the United States began to build up its forces in the South. By July, 125,000 Americans were fighting in Vietnam.
Some Americans became angry. Anti-war demonstrations took place in the cities of San Francisco and Chicago. More and more students began to protest. They wanted the war to end quickly. Writer James Reston commented that the anti-war demonstrations were not helping to bring peace to Vietnam. He said they were postponing it. He believed the demonstrations would make Ho Chi Minh think America did not support its troops, and that, he said, would make President Ho continue the war.
In December 1965, the United States again halted air attacks against North Vietnam. Again, it invited the North Vietnamese government to negotiate an end to the fighting. And again, the North refused. Ho Chi Minh's conditions for peace were firm. He demanded an end to the bombing and a complete American withdrawal. Withdrawal would mean defeat for the South. It would mean that all of Vietnam would become communist. President Johnson would not accept these terms, so he offered his own proposals. The most important was an immediate ceasefire. Neither side would compromise, however, and the fighting went on.
In 1966, President Johnson renewed the bombing attacks in North Vietnam. He also increased the number of American troops in South Vietnam. He condemned those who opposed his policies. He said, "The American people will stand united until every soldier is brought home safely. They will stand united until the people of South Vietnam can choose their own government."
Local and state elections were held in the United States that year. The war in Vietnam had an effect on those elections. The opposition Republican Party generally supported the president's war efforts, yet it criticized him and other Democrats for economic problems linked to the war. The war cost $2,000 million every month. The price of many goods in the United States began to rise. The value of the dollar began to drop. The result was inflation. Then economic activity slowed, and the result was recession.
To answer the criticism, administration officials said progress was being made in Vietnam. But some Americans began to suspect that the government was not telling the truth about the war. Several news writers, for example, said the number of enemy soldiers killed was much lower than the government reported. Opposition to the war and to the administration's war policies led to bigger and bigger anti-war demonstrations. Studies were done to measure Americans' opinion on the issue. In a study in July 1967, a little more than half the people questioned said they did not approve of the president's policies. Yet most Americans believed he would run again for president the next year.
Johnson strongly defended the use of American soldiers in Vietnam. In a speech to a group of lawmakers, he said, "Since World War II, this nation has met and has mastered many challenges. Challenges in Greece and Turkey, in Berlin, in Korea, in Cuba. We met them because brave men were willing to risk their lives for their nation's security. And braver men have never lived than those who carry our colors in Vietnam this very hour."
Then came Tet, the Vietnamese Lunar New Year, in January 1968. The communists launched a major military campaign. They attacked 31 of the 44 provinces of South Vietnam. They even struck at the American embassy in the capital, Saigon. 50,000 communist soldiers were killed during the Tet Offensive. 14,000 South Vietnamese soldiers were killed, and 2,000 American soldiers were killed. Thousands of Vietnamese civilians were killed, too.
Many Americans were surprised, even shocked, that the communists could launch such a major attack against South Vietnam. For several years, they had been told that communist forces were small and were losing badly. As a result, popular support for the administration fell even more. Democrats who opposed President Johnson seized this chance. Several ran against him in the primary elections held before the party's presidential nominating convention. These included Senator Robert Kennedy of New York and Senator Eugene McCarthy of Minnesota. Kennedy and McCarthy did well in the early primary elections. Johnson did poorly.
At the end of March 1968, the president spoke to the American people on television. He told of his proposal to end American bombing of North Vietnam. He told of the appointment of a special ambassador to start peace negotiations. And he told of his decision about his own future.
"I do not believe that I should devote an hour or a day of my time to any personal partisan causes or to any duties other than the awesome duties of this office, the presidency of your country. Accordingly, I shall not seek, and I will not accept, the nomination of my party for another term as your president."
This program, The Making of a Nation, was written by Jerry Watson and produced by Paul Thompson. This is Phil Murray.
And this is Doug Johnson. Join us again next week for another VOA Special English program about the history of the United States.